All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
This episode of La Verdad Podcast is brought to you by Sonia Figueroa of CSonia.com.
Are you looking to buy a house or perhaps thinking about selling your home? Look no further and let our chica, Sonia Figueroa, help you out.
With now over 12 years of experience in real estate, Sonia has helped over 200 sellers and buyers combined in the last couple of years. So if you're a first-time home buyer or perhaps a first-time seller, Sonia is your go-to chica.
Definitely. And I'm sure some of you maybe have already started your own research online, reading things that probably actually don't make any sense to you because it's your first time buying. Or maybe you have spoken to other people but haven't found someone that actually knows what they're doing.
Well, you know what? If this sounds like you, reach out to Sonia Figueroa at www.csonia.com. That is www.seesonia.com or any social media outlet. And mi gente, don't forget, she also speaks Spanish. Habla español.
You're now listening to La Verdad Podcast.
We're back at it again with another episode of La Verdad Podcast, and this is your host Christian, and I'm joined by the beautiful B Fig. How are you?
I'm good. What's up?
It's a little hot now.
I'm still cold. I don't know what this is. Like, you're like always hot. I'm freezing
when it comes
all
down
the
to
time.
When it comes down to recording, I don't know what it is. My temperature rises and I get all hot, and then eventually afuera is really nice and cold and all that. But I guess it's the adrenaline that rushes and all that. Also, you know, we've been recording. This is our second show today, so yep. If you hear my voice a little hoarse, I always say this in every show.
You do.
And I like to apologize in the beginning. Mi gente, before we continue with the show, though, I do want to ask you to go ahead and subscribe to the podcast. We're available through iTunes, any outlet out there that you listen to podcasts. We're basically available. Audio Boom, iTunes, also available on social media as @LaVerdadLTD. But for today's show, we've been kind of bringing different people in, right? I always like to bring in people from the Chicago community that are doing extraordinary things. The guest that we have here today is actually the executive director of the Segundo Ruiz Belvis Cultural Center, which I've been to, and it's beautiful. He's also the CEO and founder of Agusate, which we'll talk a little bit more in the podcast. But today joining us at La Verdad Studio is Omar Torres Courtright. How are you, man?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. It's a great honor to be here. I love what you guys are doing.
Thank you so much. You know what? Thank you for coming by. You know, I know you probably super busy. I know you guys have one of the things that I wanted to bring up in the podcast was that the cultural center always has something going on. Mm-hmm. And I love that because it's not just basic little, you know, workshops here and there. They have that, but they also have concerts. And also, you're a busy man, and thank you for
and
taking time.
And it's organized considering, you know, the Latino culture and how they do things. It's very organized. So that's awesome.
Thank you. So before we jump into the cultural center, I kind of wanted to explain how I got curious to know who you are. So I was actually checking out a long time ago. I saw the Chamaco Ramirez story, right? And somebody had put on Facebook that you guys were fundraising for it. So that's mm-hmm. the first, you know, glimpse of who Omar Torres was, right? And then we went to the show. We went to the Boma Combuya show, and then you mentioned, oh, Chente Hidrach is coming to Chicago, and I'm a huge Chente Hidrach fan.
He's like, I want tickets.
I need to interview
buy
this
me
guy.
Tickets.
He knows the people that I like to follow. And then we went to the show, actually, and it was an amazing production. So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and what brought you to Chicago?
Thank you. I was born and raised in Puerto Rico, I was born and raised there exactly... in 1977, right? So, and I lived there the first 23 years of my life, and then I was looking to move to a big city. I considered different countries and everything. I lived in Spain for a little bit, in two different times of my life when I was a child, and then when I went later as an exchange student, and I really liked Spain, so Spain was kind of in the cards, but it didn't quite work out for me, and I was looking to either move to New York or to Chicago. I had been to Chicago through friends that I had that lived here, and friends that I met in my exchange program in Spain, of all places. So that's what, you know, that was what first brought me to Chicago. It was the idea of living in a big city, coming out of Puerto Rico, knowing that in Puerto Rico I had opportunities, but that I could maybe explore other things that I could not explore in Puerto Rico and still be very connected to the island. And that's what I decided to do here.
And you came from Rio Piedras, Puerto Rico, right?
Yes,
so very close to the San Juan area. For those who don't know, the geographical, you know, placement of Puerto Rico is actually in the northern part.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Close to San Juan, so to the east, I want to say.
It's considered San Juan already. Okay. Like San Juan, the metropolitan area, it has grown significantly, and like, you know, even Carolina, Bayamón, you know, that before, you know, it's almost the same, you know, but of course there are different municipalities in that case. In the case of Rio Piedras, it's not a different municipality, so it's already like pretty much part of San Juan.
So you came to Chicago, and then did you go straight to working at the Segundo Ruiz Belvis Cultural Center, or you had other?
No, actually, Segundo Ruiz Belvis is one of those things that has been staring in my face for the 17 years that I've been here, but I didn't really decide to jump completely and really work at Segundo Ruiz Belvis full time until I got involved first as a volunteer, then as a board member, right before that, I was the manager of language services at the Lurie Children's Hospital. Mm-hmm. It used to be Children's Memorial, and that was, I loved that job. There was a little thing missing in my life, was that I always wanted to dedicate to arts and culture, and I was very happy at the hospital because I was helping people. I was it was community work, because I felt like people that could not communicate with their doctors could come to our department and find those resources. So to me, that was a very eye-opening experience. I learned a lot about life and about the Latino community there, the Latino community of Chicago, immigrant rights.
Yeah.
So that's something that was very valuable to me. But at the same time, I was volunteering and doing all this extra stuff, like the documentary, like Agusate. And with Agusate and volunteering for Segundo Ruiz Belvis, I found myself like I was shortchanging the organization, because I never found enough time to really dedicate as much as I wanted to Segundo Ruiz Belvis. And I felt like it was such a beautiful space. It had come from generation to generation. And
at that point, was it already at the location that it is now?
Has
it
been no, I, you know, when I first started going to Segundo Ruiz Belvis to learn how to play congas and stuff like that, that was in like 2002, 2003, and they were on Milwaukee Avenue.
And now they are at?
We are at 4048 West Armitage, which is just west of Pulaski on Armitage.
And it's a big space. When, when you're first walking up, you think it's a small space, right? It's like a little storefront.
Yeah.
And we're like, wow, they're going to have the show in there.
No, we couldn't find it at first. I think we like passed it up. We're like, we're looking for this like big old building, community center type of thing.
It's a big concert, you know?
Yeah.
But then you walk in and you go to the back and you're like, whoa.
No, we thought it was a setup. Like, wait, no, there's nothing happening. We got set up. Where are we?
We get that a lot, and we're actually kind of liking it, to tell you the truth. This whole surprise, the fact that people, you know, like they, it's nice in the front, and then, you know, they walk in, they are thinking it's a storefront, and then they find this amazing space.
Yeah, really nice. I was like, wow.
So can you tell me more about the cultural center? So you started working there, but what is the main motive and main goal of the cultural center there?
Yeah, the mission is to promote Afro-Puerto Rican and Afro-Latin arts and culture.
Okay.
So from a Puerto Rican perspective, always, because the founders, although the very early founders, it was a nice mix that included Mexicans and other people from other communities. It really early on took on a very a mission to promote Puerto Rican arts, but also looking at the perspective of the Afro Afro-Puerto Rican tradition, which unites us with so many other Afro-Latino traditions, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to really push that because I think that it's very important that Puerto Rico is seen in a perspective of the world. Mm-hmm. And we have so much to offer and to share with other communities, right? So, but early on, Segundo Ruiz Belvis Cultural Center was also very focused on social justice and also a lot of social programs. Mm-hmm. So there was, you know, a lot of people come to me and say, hey, I got my GED at Segundo Ruiz Belvis.
Wow.
So that was a program that existed, right? And that it was there for a very long time. You know, and all kinds of other things, you know.
How long has it been in the community?
45 years.
Wow. It's one of the oldest one. I remember.
It's the oldest Latino cultural center in Chicago. Yeah.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah. You know, it's a great thing to see, especially that there is different locations and different places that people could go to for, you know, things such as education. You know, education is very, very, it's a strong thing that we need to do, and something that also we need to do is keeping the culture and the tradition alive, which is one of the things that we love about our show is that we want to be able to showcase that and keep it consistent throughout the years. And the fact that you guys do that, to me, it's amazing. But you mentioned that one thing right there where you want to kind of start exploring into all of the other Latin American countries that have Afro-Latino in them. So what, like what, in what ways?
So, for example, we pitched a series to the Chicago Community Trust called Las Caras Lindas, and that taking a Puerto Rican song, of course, so Ismael Rivera, the greatest salsero in the history of Puerto Rico, although, you know, I'm also doing a documentary, a really good one that I really love. But, of course, the very commonly known as the father or, you know, this rhythmic genius that was Ismael Rivera. He had this song. Was written by Tite Cure Alonso. It's Las Caras Lindas de Mi Gente Negra, right? So trying to really celebrate Afro-Puerto Ricanness, right?
Yeah.
And then to me, it was important to take that and bring it to Latin America, right? So the series has had presence from Colombia, for example, and from Cuba. And it's going to have also a presence in October of the Dominican Republic, right?
Interesting.
So events every month, events, live music events that in a way highlight Afro-Latino music and culture.
Yeah.
And I'm also interested in, you know, the innovation and tradition, trying to combine the old with the new.
Okay.
And I think that that has been also always kind of an interest of mine, that I love old music and I love new young Puerto Ricans or Latinos that are doing great work. And when I book an artist, I'm not so interested in looking at how many Facebook likes they have or like how many followers. If this is quality and it's coming from Latin America and we don't know it, we want it here. So,
and that's a very unique way of looking at it, because I know a lot of times, and I will go into Agusate in just a second, it's just that as a musician or as a promoter, you're probably looking at, okay, but I know especially in the city of Chicago, promoters might look at things as, okay, what's going to bring me more money as opposed to what is more unique and more...
Where's the talent?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Finding that pure
That's the freedom
talent.
That we have when it's fully funded by the Chicago Community Trust. It's these are free events for the community, so there's no pressure. Nobody owns us. Mm-hmm. We curate it completely. We have total independence, and we can bring acts as big as the Septeto Nacional de Cuba.
Yeah, I saw that.
I mean, we're talking four generations, 1930s, 1920s, you know, the first generation of the Septeto Nacional de Cuba. And that, of course, is an institution, right? But then you have guys like El Macabeo who are doing something completely different,
starting
new.
Out,
And, you know, and they've paid their dues. They've been around for a while now, but they are still seen as groundbreaking musicians from the island, that it's actually very I guess it's very rare that they can come to Chicago.
So do you get a lot of pushback when it comes down to these artists that are perhaps doing a fusion? They're doing something like, let's just say, Bomba, right? And mm-hmm. then they're mixing it with something else. Do you get pushback from the community on that, or is it very well received?
That's a really good question. I think that you get many different perspectives on that. For example, Segundo Ruiz Belvis has always been associated with a very traditional way of mm-hmm. interpreting Afro-Puerto Rican arts and culture with the costumes, with the mm-hmm. with everything, very much following, you know, exactly what tradition is. Yeah. And I remember having conversations, for example, with people that help, like some of the founders of the center or the very old timers that are no longer involved. But, you know, when we approached them about this comparsa de carnaval that we wanted to do, they were very concerned about how we were portraying Bejigantes. And they wanted, you know, they wanted to let us know, you know, it's important that you follow tradition and all these things. And I, you know, at first that, of course, we want to follow tradition. And then when I bring this artist from Puerto Rico who's doing all the comparsas in San Sebastian, the first thing that he says when he starts the workshop is throw tradition out the window, basically, because what we want you to do is to be inspired by tradition. But there's no way that in this workshop you're going to learn the perfect tradition and stay completely faithful to it and not make a mistake. So I'm going to free you from all that.
Yeah.
And I want you to interpret the Bejigante. These are the Bejigantes. Yeah. This is the Ponce tradition. This is the Loíza tradition. And ones are made of coconut and the other ones are paper mache. Those are the pictures. Now we're going to take them down and you're going to do your own thing, right? You're going to be inspired. So I also like that because mm-hmm. it's important to bring new audiences to what is Puerto Rican culture and Afro-Latino culture and the carnaval and all these things. And you're not going to bring them if you're not a little flexible in the way, mm-hmm. you know, you let them interpret also.
And I think the whole point, too, and I was mentioning this on the last podcast with Melissa, was that we have to find a way to plant that seed, you know, whether or not they don't like it after they know a little bit more about it. But at least you planted the seed of who we are, what we do, and why we do it, right? For those that don't know what a Bejigante is or a comparsa, the easiest thing to say is Google. Go to Google. I'll put it up there. But the Bejigantes have been around for many, 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 many years. We used to even have a big careta here in the house. And, you know, you guys were doing workshops so people could come in and create their own Bejigante, right? The actual careta.
Yeah, we've done these workshops a couple of times, and the first time we did it with Agua Sol y Sereno, a theater company from Puerto Rico, and then this time we brought an even bigger group from another theater company, because this year we were funded by the MacArthur Foundation, so that was huge. Mm-hmm. We got the International Connections grant, and this whole group of artists came and were here for a month. So
they're doing a residency?
A residency of an entire month where they taught, you know, as many community members as wanted to learn.
Wow.
Basically, the art of puppet, mask making, but also very free in terms of, okay, be inspired by the Bejigante, but, you know, don't get caught up in doing it perfectly like the tradition. And so we did puppets of the Bejigantes, and people, like, got really creative there. Yeah. And we did other kinds of masks, and, you know, we also had our cabezudos from when the first group came. Yeah.
So that's originally from one of the... When were the cabezudos made? A while back?
Yeah, our cabezudos were made by Pedro Adorno Irizarry with his company called Agua Sol y Sereno.
Okay.
And they were here in June 2015.
Okay.
And they were part of a project that we did with the 606, where we brought the comparsa de carnaval to the 606. And they, you know, that allowed us to keep these artists for like 3 weeks here teaching the community and all that. And this time we were able to get them to do, okay, the 606, but then the Puerto Rican period. So we were able to all that entire time teach the community and bring it to the Puerto Rican parade for the first time.
Awesome. So I know you guys were in the 606, and for those who don't know know what the 606 is. The 606 is a trail that takes up the old Bloomingdale train line, right? So there used to be a train that would go past mostly other neighborhoods that are Latino focused, kind of. Mm-hmm. So it goes, I don't know exactly how long it is, but it goes a very long stretch, and they created a bike trail and a track, you know, that you could actually go in, and there's so many cool little things there. You guys were part of the inauguration of it, right?
Yes, well? Yes, yeah. Yes.
And then now you did a whole year after.
Yes,
right. So like the anniversary. So they were part of the
actually it's second year.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So they were part of that comparsa.
Yeah, and they also involve us in the curating of the acts that go on the stages. So okay. You know, there's a very strong cultural presence that we help curate there.
Okay. So question on when you're booking these artists and you're looking for all these things, is that you just going in online, and or do you have a background of music and you know these people from back when you were in Puerto Rico, or how does it work?
So because I went to the University of Puerto Rico and because I constantly go to Puerto Rico. I go to Puerto Rico. I can go to Puerto Rico sometimes five times a year, and I try to.
Wow. Wow.
and I do whatever I can to do that.
That's
so
awesome.
Like even if I don't have the money, I find the money. You know, yeah. Like I find ways to stay connected to Puerto Rico, because that's the only way that I can really thrive at the work that I do. Right?
Interesting, yeah.
So by constantly going to the island and constantly following and staying connected socially and through social media with all the artists that I respect, they open a whole network of artists that I learn about. Mm-hmm. And I specifically look for artists that are outside of the mainstream. Mm-hmm. I obviously don't have a problem with artists that are in the mainstream, and I have worked with many very famous artists, yeah. But I also like to keep it where it's accessible to the artistic community in Puerto Rico and accessible to the artistic community here. And I try for, when I do work with world-renowned musicians, for them to have contact with our youth and with our aspiring musicians from the community.
And it's one of those things, too, that I try to do the same. I try to always go with the artists that are not mainstream. Something mm-hmm. that my dad taught me from a long time ago. My dad's always, he's a big salsero, mm-hmm. and he's always looking for whatever's new in the island. So, like, Macabeo, Pirulo, La Tribu, all these mm-hmm. bands that are not really well-known.
Well, he's like your, like, here, living newspaper for Puerto Rico.
No less
he
here.
So
in
much.
The case of Pirulo, he exploded. He's, like, he's going to Colombia and Peru and everything. But still here,
but
less known.
Come here, you know
less
what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
so that was one of the things too that I loved about the cultural center, because it was like every single artist that I was hearing about, you guys were bringing. I'm like, this guy thinks very similar. So it's one of those things that, to me, as a musician and someone that has studied music, I love to be able to go out and look at the independent artists that are out there, because there's some stuff out there, that some musicians out there that are just phenomenal, and no one ever really taps into it. But sometimes they choose not to mm-hmm, mm-hmm. not to be out there mainstream, you know, because then they get into just a specific category, and they can't really explore.
Or they're capped on certain things that they can do instead of just being free to do their to live their talent.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. So. You also do Aguzate, mm-hmm. which is, yes. Can you explain that a little bit more?
So Aguzate started as, we started it like kind of as an online portal when internet was, you know, like still very young and all that. But as soon as I moved here, I wanted to create that space that was Afro-Latino, right? And that's something that, even though people understand it, you know, there's very few movements that are like really embracing that mm-hmm. in Chicago for some reason, or like going out there and saying Afro-Latino,
this is
right?
Who we are, yeah.
So I felt that there was a void there. There was an opportunity, and Aguzate became a place where this is a project that was started by me and also my friend Abner Bardeguez, who's a poet from Chicago, works right now in a program at the University of Chicago. But he was one of the people that really encouraged me to you know, really find this space, right? So we created the website to start, you know, putting our articles and doing collaborations with artists. And I guess the biggest project that came out of it in terms of live music was the annual tribute to the improvisational singer or the sonero that we did for about 12 years. And that that at this moment we're taking a little break of that project, but we want to bring it back. And we did it at many different venues, but the venue that really embraced more what we were trying to do was the Old Town School of Folk Music. So we collaborated with Mateo Mulcahy, who's the director there of community programs, and he's a big salsero, so it was like a really easy connection there,
which is one of those venues also that will bring in a lot of good acts.
Yes,
I saw Cultura Profética.
Yes, there you go.
So very big name artists in Latin America.
Yes,
brought him to that
piece. He has a very good eye. Mateo has a great eye for great Latin American music. And he has opened my eyes to a lot of Colombian music and Brazilian music and music from all over. So Agusate started like that, and then we started writing articles. We started inviting some people to write with us. And then at some point we got involved in this documentary thing, which Agusate is co-producing, co-directing with another company from Chicago that is now in New York. That's called De Boca Films. And that's my partner in the whole
And Chamaco that documentary project. Is the Chamaco Ramirez story.
Yeah, it's called Alive and Kicking, La Historia de Chamaco Ramirez.
Who used to sing for Tommy Lee Vencia.
Yes, right? Exactly.
So for those who are salsero and who are not salsero, check it out. It's one of those things where you start looking more into who that person was and you're understanding where that passion to the music came from. I'm a big advocate for listening. For example, everybody talks about Hector Lavoe, so I like to dig in there and see why was he so successful in what he did, but it was the passion that brought
you
know the problems that he had in life that brought out the feeling in his music, the saoko in his music, you know. So
for sure.
Have you been a salsero all your life? Is it something that do you play?
I don't play.
Okay.
I have maybe a little too much respect for the music to play it. I've always been kind of like this frustrating musician. I'm gonna be very sincere with you. And I always felt how can I stay close to the music without being a musician? So I've, you know, in a way, kind of found my niche there, right? Yes, I've always been a salsero. I was kind of weird when I was in high school because it wasn't like super in to be salsero, you know? Maybe knowing some of the like hits in the radio kind of thing, Gilberto Santa Rosa, very polished, which I love Gilberto Santa Rosa, don't get me wrong, but like it's a very specific, very commercial kind of salsa that appeals to a broader public. Of the commercials, salseros is the one that I respect the most for sure. I was into, you know, not only Fania, but Inca records and Zico records. And like I was collecting music early on in high school. And I was interested in La Vieja Escuela de la Salsa. So like, you know, Frankie Levy and like obscure stuff, right? Obscure for certain people.
And it's interesting too. Sorry to cut you off, but it's interesting because it's during the time. You know, because salsa it has gone through phases, right? I believe that it's gone through phases. You had the salsa gorda, you know, originally, you know, talking about stuff that was happening in El Barrio, and then you got into the salsa romántica, or some other people call salsa monga, you know, which
exactly.
is, like you were mentioning, the commercialized salsa.
Yeah.
And I want to say, you know, even though it was very soft, very relaxed music, it did take salsa to a bigger audience as well.
For sure.
I feel like it's starting to come back as the salsa gorda, especially with bands like Macabeo y Pirulo La Tribu. They're trying to, you know, get back to the neighborhoods and the roots of what salsa was. So during that time, you're saying, you know, a lot of people were not really into that unless it was the mainstream. So you were the oddball.
Yeah.
Listening to salsa gorda.
I was. Like, literally, like, with my headphones, like, in the lockers, you know.
But
like,
was it something that
changing, you know, to the next class, and, you know, I was singing Hector Lavoe, and people were like...
It's a viejo.
But then I realized that by me putting out there that I liked it, some people started to, like, also, like, share with me that, no, yeah, you gotta come and check out my dad's collection, man.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
and then I started like, and even saw like some like high school, what do you call the these talent shows, uh-huh. And like to me, like one of the best talent shows was when they did like something like Hector Lavoe or Pedro Navaja.
Wow.
And these were like the older guys, you know, like the ones that were seniors when we were like you know, freshmen, yeah. Or like eighth grade. To me, it was so cool that they were doing Pedro Navaja. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh my God, you know, these guys know what's up. Like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then people looking at me like, whatever. You know?
I want to say the equivalent of like us liking, you know, old school Salsa is the equivalent of some of our like metalheads or people, yeah. That love the old school rock, you know, that they collect the vinyls. Yeah. I've been the same way. Like I will go through my dad's old vinyl collection, which he doesn't let me touch. And I'll pull up albums and just the carátula, right? The album, yeah. Cover of that, mm-hmm. of that particular artist was very unique, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to nowadays. Nowadays you have everything online. Unfortunately, we don't have that. You can't open it and read it.
Although it's coming back.
You think? Yeah, you think
it's
so?
It's coming back.
Is it,
yeah.
Gonna come back?
Yeah, because of the problem. I mean, it's coming back. It will never be as big as
it once.
You
was.
Know, like as it was. But collectors are going back to vinyl because they want to have. They want to have that experience.
It was an experience, yeah.
They want to be able to read everything that's on there, and they want to keep that physical copy, which in the case of vinyl is the closest thing to the original recording,
yes,
really.
Yes.
And people are starting to realize that, okay, now digital music kind of lost its value because, mm-hmm. you can just get it on Spotify or anywhere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if I'm going to be a collector of music, I kind of have to go back to vinyl. So, yeah. That's what you're seeing with a lot of people.
And obviously. Not only that, I mean, I'm going to geek out right now.
Uh-huh. You both are. I'm just like, Carrie, keep talking.
When it comes down to digital music, right, as a engineer, you'll see that it crunches up your audio file.
Yeah,
and
you
see that all the time. With vinyl, you get that, like you said, the most original. You hear the sound, you hear the dead space, the air that's coming out. If you've, yeah. never listened to an album, I'm telling you, go to the shop and pick,
man.
Up, go to one of the shops here in Chicago. I'm sure there's a couple, or just come by the house and I'll, yeah. put one of the old albums.
Go through your dad's albums.
I mean, it was to the point
to
where I used to work for a music retail shop for a very long time, and people were coming in and trading in their turntables. And in my mind, I'm like, man, I need to get these turntables. I bought two turntables, Techniques 1200s. And I had them, you know, and I remember to my dad, he keeps them all clean and all that. Then it became the whole craze of CDs, right, for a while. That they started coming back, and now it's all digital. And now they're coming back with the albums. I remember for 3 years ago when I was working there, they came in, and one of those turntables that they sold for $150 of Technique 1200 was selling for almost $800 in the market nowadays. So it's because they want to feel the experience, mm-hmm. that we lost. So one of the things too that I love about Agusate is that you're taking the old school, you know, elements that were perhaps lost. You know, it's all word of mouth, and not a lot of people out there are actually documenting what happened. For example, the only other person that I could think of that documents or have been documenting a lot of stuff is Easy Sanabria, right?
Oh, which, yeah.
From,
oh,
New
my
York.
God, yeah.
But I also feel like, I remember I was talking to my dad about it, that not a lot of people documented the Chicago story of salsa. You know, there was a lot of pictures here and there that were lost, but there was two big distinct ways, or three actually. You have the salsa in Puerto Rico, right? In those times, you have the New York salsa and Chicago. Do you have an idea of that? Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know what? I have to say that there's just, that is a project that, you know, recently in NPR, they, like a few years back, they did a whole story on Chicago salsa.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got the vinyl and everything, and, you know, you got, you know, La Confidencia, mm-hmm. and all these bands from the 70s, and I started a research project there, but I have just so much more to go in terms of Chicago salsa.
Yeah.
I still don't consider myself an expert on Chicago salsa, but it's there.
Yeah.
And there's an opportunity there to really like dig deeper and really make, you know, come up with a really good history of Chicago, yeah. salsa, because, you know, we're always kind of in this situation where New York York is always overshadowing Chicago, right? Mm-hmm. And the reality is that we've always had very high-quality musicians in Chicago.
Very, very, yeah.
And salsa has had a really good history here. And even, you know, like, there's some crazy stuff. You can go back to, like, late 50s, early mm-hmm. 60s, and you'll find, you know, groups were like, and after hours were like, and times were like, big musicians would stay for long periods of time in Chicago and would even record. Like,
I lived here.
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah. Man. Like, Mongo Santa Maria, for example, he had times where, like, he spent a lot of time in the after hours in Chicago, and he inspired a lot of musicians. Rudy Calzado, he was one that did a charanga back in the, you know, late 60s, early 60s in Chicago. And then from there, you have the Salsa and La Confidencia and all these great bands. So I think that there's an opportunity there. I think that definitely I've been more involved with the Bomba Plena folkloric scene here. Obviously, I've done a lot of salsa recently, but there's a whole time between 1970 to like the 90s that there's so much to document and so much work to be done.
And we actually had a podcast about that, one of the original podcasts, like I think episode 3 or 4 was with my uncle, who was part of all those like salsa bands back when Caribe was around. And he explains a little bit more into detail how it was, what happened, eventually what took over. And it's a project that's always been on my mind. It's something that even before La Verdad was in my mind, I had a project, an idea to create a documentary about the Chicago salsa. So maybe I'll talk to you.
There's definitely an opportunity there. And
There's so much because yes. Chicago molded a lot of the salsa singers from nowadays, you know, even the mainstream salsa singers. You talk to people, for example, in the festival, which was what, last week, 2 weeks ago? You had Imael Miranda, who was up there on stage, talking about he used to hang out here all the time in Chicago, you know, and get ideas from the musicians. When you mentioned
Santiago lived here. Yeah. I heard even Cheo Feliciano spent a few months here.
I think he had family here.
Yeah, I don't know if he like lived like for a whole year, but like he found Chicago interesting and good enough to like take a chunk of his, you know, career time and say, you know, I'm gonna live here for a little bit because, you know, I like what's happening here, right? Even in my documentary, I'm still kind of after a story. So if anybody knows, I'm after a story about Chamaco living here.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And supposedly,
wait, around what time?
It would have been in the 70s. I'm placing him here sometime between 74 and 79. And granted that some of that period he was in jail and he was like moving around a lot. So there's very little information on exactly where he was, but we have heard stories of people that say, no, I met him in Chicago. He gave me an opportunity in Chicago. Or like, oh, he was hiding from somebody, so he came to Chicago.
Theo Luis, who's probably listening to this right now, you probably played with him. Let us know.
You please know. If anybody has any stories of Chamaco Ramirez in Chicago, I would like to know.
Because my uncle, Luis Alequin, you know, which was well-known percussionist here in Chicago, I remember him telling me a story of Chamaco Ramirez, and you could probably elaborate more, where he will sing with a gun.
Oh, my God.
Because he was somebody del barrio.
Yeah.
Probably hot. You know, people met him. So
well,
can you
actually,
talk a little bit?
Yeah, so basically Chamaco, in a way, that's really what I think that his biggest conflict was, that he had a life that he could not escape, right? So, like, he was a product of a very difficult time in Puerto Rico and in the South Bronx, right? So he lived the South Bronx during the heroin epidemic, and he was somebody who made a lot of mistakes, but also was also a product of the times, right? So, so Chamaco Ramirez, in terms of his lifestyle, when we cover in the documentary that part where he is fearing for his life to the point where he can't go on stage without a gun, is because he had this conflict. It's like, what is it that I love to do more than anything is to sing, right? Yeah. But if I sing, I could lose my life because people are after me, right?
Yeah.
So he decided that he wasn't going to care about that anymore. So he wanted to continue pursuing his career as an artist, and he decided to just go out there and say, I'm here, I'm alive, I'm singing. Yeah. And that's what Alive and Kicking is. Alive and Kicking was the name of the album that he produced before he died. Mm. And he's coming out of a coffin, basically, in that album cover. Yeah. And it's a way of saying, well, they already said I'm dead. They already said I'm supposed to be dead, and that if I come out, you know, I'll probably die. So this is me. I'm coming out. And this is what I'm bringing. This is the new album, right? That story of that album is very interesting because Ismael Rivera, at the time, mm-hmm. he was the cash cow of Fania, but he was in decline. As Fania was in decline, he was in decline because he was losing his voice. Yeah. Ismael Rivera, the greatest singer, losing his voice. So Fania was freaking out because they needed to come up with a successor for Ismael Rivera. And the natural successor was Chamaco Ramirez. When Jenny Masucci asked, where is Chamaco? He's in jail.
Oh.
So he put together a group of lawyers to get him out of jail. And the idea was for him to be the successor of Ismael Rivera, you know?
Now, to give a timeline idea of this, and like I said, man, I'm geeking out on this. I'm going there. Chamaco Ramirez, during the same time as Hector Lavoe?
He's a little older than Hector Lavoe. He was actually, this is a story that not a lot of people know, but Chamaco Ramirez was Hector Lavoe's favorite sonero, you know, like there's stories of him going into a rehearsal and finding the Tommy Olivencia Orchestra rehearsing before them, and him lining up his whole band and says, we're going to sit down because you're going to listen to the best sonero out there.
Wow.
So we take a break, we sit down, we listen to Chamaco Ramirez, even if it's a rehearsal, right? And Chamaco, the way he phrased and the way he connected with the con la gente del pueblo was very similar to the way that Hector Lavoe connected. And
exactly.
You know, they say that Hector Lavoe made being Jibarito cool, right?
Yeah.
So Chamaco wasn't, he was a city guy, right?
Yeah.
But he brought that coolness to the barrios of the city, right? Mm-hmm. And he didn't have to say that was the best thing about him. Fun. He didn't have to say, oh, I have all this money, I have all these women, I have my gun.
Mm-hmm.
He never mentions any of that.
Yep.
But people could understand where he came from by the way he connected with the people. He wasn't showing off. It was just natural. It was, you know, this is who I am. Like Plante Bandera, isn't that the most beautifully worded tiraera that you've ever heard in your life?
And it was written by him?
It wasn't. Okay. But the soneos are his.
The way that he...
Yeah, he improvised. He made it his.
Yeah.
But who was the writer? Tite Gure Alonso, you know? Yeah. Doesn't get better than that as a writer either in salsa, so...
And it's one of those things, too. Like, I also listen to a lot of, you know, modern stuff. So right now in Puerto Rico, lo que está pegando el trap or el reggaeton, you know, very big tiraera
on
there. But you have to always look at the past, right? So you see, you know, salseros that were doing tiraera at the time. You hear some great songs that are just doing some straight up tiraera. And the rappers nowadays or reggaetoneros, you know, you have Teo Calderon who admires, you know, the old school salsa and uses words that they used to use back in the day.
He has a part in our documentary because he has a part in our documentary because it's important to put it in the perspective of this guy went beyond influencing salseros. Mm-hmm. He influenced a whole generation of salseros, but he influenced the pillars of the urban music of Puerto Rico. You know, Vico C and Teo Calderon. You know?
They're two of the biggest. Yeah. Vico C, probably the most well-known, you know, rapper.
Yeah. And now there's a movie coming about him.
Yeah, I saw that it came out a couple of weeks ago in certain locations. I think Florida, obviously, because it's where Vico C lives at. They have the La Vida del Filósofo.
Yeah.
Vico C is one of those guys that I've always wanted to have in the podcast. It's one of my, like, I have a couple goals, right, of who I need to interview in
his
this podcast.
Dream interview.
Vico C is my top one because it's one of the people that I grew up listening to. It was the first one that I got into hip-hop and actually reggaeton from. But the reason I brought up the reggaeton was because they do use a lot of the old words, and they do use a lot of the stuff from salsa. And unfortunately, some of them will say, oh, it's a cosa de viejo, la vieja guardia, this and that. But they don't understand that it actually shaped a lot of the music that they listen to now and that they create now.
Yeah.
So outside of the Chamaco Ramirez, what else are you working on with Agusate? Any other shows that are coming up?
Well, important to give an update on the documentary because it's still in the making. We filmed 60 interviews. We already went into post production, but we have the public knows this. Basically, we have a little bit of an issue right now in the negotiation of our music rights to include all the music that we want to include in the film. So we sat down with what is now Fania Records is called Código Music. Okay. And we're trying to come to an agreement so that this, we've already invested money, blood, sweat, tears, and it's to a point where like that project is ready to go, but it really needs a little more support from the people. We already asked people to come and donate for the film, and they came big time. We really need Fania and the Código people to see this movie as what it is.
Yeah.
It's only gonna be a promotion of an artist that in a way está engavetado, you know, you could say. Yep. Because Chamaco Ramirez, yes, the hardcore salseros know who he is, but so much so many more people could know about his life and the legacy and all this music that Fania doesn't even own, right? That was produced and that we have found, and these acapellas and all kinds of stuff that's really amazing, and videos that haven't been released. So.
And for those of you listening too, I know we've thrown the word out there a lot of times. Fania was probably the biggest record label when it came down to the original salsa. A lot of people might know it as Fania All Stars because they had Celia Cruz, they had all these big name artists. Hector Lavoe was part of it as well. Ray Barreto, you know, all these different artists on there. So if you want to understand a little bit more of Fania or what was happening?
All the guys we
had on the wall. If you want to understand more about Fania, you will understand what was happening during the time and how all these musicians and artists from Puerto Rico and New York kind of got together and joined that one big mainstream label that was around the area. I want to say thank you so much for coming by. I could sit here and talk for hours. And
I'm sure
we could do that
on salsa
and the history of salsa. You brought up another idea in my head for something that we're going to have to talk about after, perhaps doing a documentary on the Chicago salsa story.
For sure. That's very much
needed. Where can people find you if they want to go to the cultural center? What would you recommend for them to look at?
Yeah, so Segundo Ruiz Belvis, srbcc.org. That's where you find everything that we're doing. We just finished our MacArthur Foundation residency, and we're moving into the live music events with Night Out in the Parks and also at the center. So Orquesta El Macabeo is going to have three shows, and they're all free of charge.
Wow.
One at the center, one in the parks, and one in Summerdale. So like you have three shows to choose from there, and that's coming. And then we're bringing El Topo to the center also for a tribute to El Topo, and we have also just many things in store. We're applying for a whole bunch of grants, so we're hoping that some of those funders will come through and we'll be able to offer the same kind of quality events that we offered this last year, years coming.
So, mi gente, make sure that we support an awesome initiative that's here in the community, an awesome resource that's here in the community for us to go back in time and kind of understand where we came from. Also, for Agusate, if they wanted to follow that and find out about the documentary?
Agusate.org. Right now, I, because of my work with Segundo Ruiz Belvis, at my day-to-day keeping of Agusate is now delegated to a really amazing guy called Don Masica. Okay. And he is the one who's like collaborating with other writers that are going to be starting to write for Agusate. He's keeping a lot of the momentum of the page. And there you can go to our documentary section and you can see two trailers that we've put together. Awesome. One a 3-minute preview and another a 5-minute. They're both completely different, and we're hoping that it will help us get the word out. And we're hoping that by the end of this year we'll have at least a date that we can say this is when the documentary is coming out. Yeah,
when it comes out, let me know. I'll definitely be there. Please. As you guys heard, we definitely covered a lot of ground today. It's something that I'm sure I want to pick your brain and talk a little bit more. Perhaps we could work together on some stuff. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know your busy schedule, for coming by and hanging out with us.
Yeah, at the Lavin Dot Studio.
For anybody out there that's looking at online or anything like that, if you want to follow us, go ahead. Or I ask that you please follow us. Any social media outlet, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, check us out as @LaVerdadLTD. Make sure you share this and talk to other people about it and put our name out there. And once again, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you. Peace. It's been a pleasure.
And God bless, mi gente. Peace.
Thank you.